So, in less than 10 minutes, right, a piece of plastic with absolutely zero performance upgrades caused a multi-billion dollar company's entire digital infrastructure to just completely
I
collapse.
mean, it is a phenomenal metric for sheer, unbridled consumer anticipation.
It's absolute chaos. Welcome to today's deep dive, everyone. We are looking at a massive intelligence drop today from the TechKnight broadcast of September 11th, 2026.
And the data compiled by Tech and Game here, it offers this incredibly rare, really a 360-degree snapshot of a gaming industry that is caught in the middle of a massive transformation.
Yeah, we have a huge stack of data to get through. We're pulling apart everything from hardware hype that literally breaks the internet
Yeah.
to technical leaps on new consoles and, crucially, the evolving rights of the human beings who are actually writing the code.
Which is arguably the most impactful part of the report.
Oh, 100%. Okay, let's unpack this, starting with that piece of plastic.
Right. The Vice City limited edition DualSense controllers for GTA 6.
Yeah. So Sony unveiled these to celebrate the impending November 19th release of GTA 6. And the second that pre-orders went live, the PlayStation Direct website just buckled. I mean, it completely buckled under the weight of the
Yeah,
traffic.
they sold out in under 10 minutes,
Huh?
which is staggering when you isolate what this product actually is. I mean, it's an $84.99 accessory.
Or 74 pounds and 99 pence in the UK.
Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly. It doesn't unlock new missions, right? It doesn't give you faster trigger response times in the game. And the haptic motors, they're identical to the standard controller sitting on your coffee table right now.
Just a paint job.
It is purely cosmetic. But it proves the cultural gravity of GTA 6 is so immense that even its peripheral accessories are being treated as essentially high-yield financial
I
assets.
gotta say, though, the design is genuinely fascinating from a manufacturing standpoint. They are using the specialized color-shifting finish. So instead of flat paint, the plastic has these
Right,
microfacets.
they refract light differently depending on your viewing angle.
Yeah, and the ambient lighting in your room. So it's like holding a living hologram in your hands.
It operates on the same visual principle as iridescent beetle shells or, certain high-end automotive paints. As you physically tilt the gamepad, the dominant color profile shifts.
And Sony actually split this into two distinct aesthetics. You have the white edition, which channels those classic neon nights, right? Heavy blues, greens, purples. And that one hit all general retailers.
But then you have the black edition.
Right. The black edition, which shifts through sunset hues, so oranges and pinks. And that one was a PlayStation Direct exclusive.
And that exclusivity is the catalyst for the server collapse. By funneling the entire global demand for the Black Edition through a single digital storefront, Sony created a bottleneck.
Which bots just love.
Exactly.
Oh, okay.
Automated scalper bots are designed to exploit those exact bottlenecks. They ping the checkout server thousands of times a second. They bypass the visual storefront entirely, which, overloads the queue for human buyers.
Wait, hold on, though. Are we really supposed to believe Sony just grossly underestimated the demand here? Because, I mean, after a 13-year wait since GTA 5, funneling an exclusive item through one site, it feels like textbook artificial scarcity, right? Designed to engineer FOMO.
Fear of missing out.
Yeah. Genuine fans are locked out while eBay and StockX are flooded with listings marked up to $250 or more. That is a 200% markup within an hour. Are companies doing this on purpose?
Well, the data certainly points to a calculated marketing strategy, generating day one headlines about sold out, record-breaking demand. That sets a narrative tone for the game's release.
It builds the hype machine.
It does. The accessory market is closely mirroring the sneaker market's drop culture now. If you manage to check out, you now own a piece of gaming memorabilia that will likely appreciate in value. But if the bots beat you, well, the data suggests you are better off saving the premium and just playing the game with a standard controller.
Right. So if artificial scarcity is about companies tightly controlling the market, let's look at a company finally relinquishing control over how our displays render their games. Switch 2 owners, Nintendo just pushed system update 23.0.
And this is huge. This brings VRR, or variable refresh rate, to the Switch 2's docked mode for televisions.
Finally. I mean, the Switch 2 launched in May 2025 with VRR fully operational on the handheld screen, but they locked it out of the TV dock for 16 months.
To understand why this update is a massive deal, we kind of need to look at what happens when a game's perfect. It is. But VRR fundamentally changes that relationship. It turns the console into the conductor. The Switch 2 now tells the television's scalar chip, Hey, I am only rendering 54 frames right now, so you need to instantly drop your refresh rate to 54 hertz.
And because they remain perfectly synchronized on a millisecond level, those frame rate drops become entirely imperceptible to the human eye. So why wait 16 months to activate it for the TV?
Well, what's fascinating here is the tech and analysis team points to the nightmare of HDMI handshakes.
Oh, right, because TVs are all so different.
The television market is wildly fragmented. Pushing a VRR update to tens of millions of users means interacting with thousands of different TV models, many of which have, frankly, cheap scalar chips that flicker or drop the video signal entirely when the refresh rate fluctuates.
And Nintendo hates that. They prioritize a frictionless user experience.
Right. They likely spent the last 16 months silently testing firmware combinations to ensure that when they finally flipped the switch on VRR, it didn't result in 5 million angry customer service calls about broken televisions.
Which makes sense. They also slipped a handheld mode boost toggle into the quick settings, which is pretty cool. You don't even have to close your game. You just flick the toggle, and it instructs the battery to feed more voltage to the GPU clock speeds.
Of course, your battery life plummets.
Oh, it completely tanks, but you get a smoother frame rate on the commute, so it's a trade-off.
It's a brilliant delegation of power to the user. But bringing VRR to the dock finally brings the Switch 2 to feature parity with the PS5 and Xbox Series.
Which raises a really crucial question about Nintendo's upcoming slate. If VRR is only really beneficial for games with variable frame rates, like games perfectly locked at 60 frames per second, like Mario Kart 8 Deluxe, they don't actually need VRR because they never miss a beat.
Right. VRR is a safety net.
Exactly. A safety net for games that struggle to maintain their target. So, is Nintendo silently admitting that their upcoming blockbusters are going to struggle to lock at a perfect 60 FPS? Are they just too ambitious?
It is less an admission of failure and more a strategic adoption of modern rendering realities. When developers are pushing hardware to its absolute mathematical limits, you know, calculating real-time lighting, complex physics, massive geometry, maintaining a perfectly locked frame rate is computationally brutal.
So it just gives them breathing room.
Yes. VRR gives developers permission to push the graphical fidelity higher, knowing that if the frame rate dips by 5 or 10 frames during an intense boss fight, the player's television will mask the struggle seamlessly.
Okay, but if VRR is the safety net for games that occasionally stumble, what happens when a developer decides to remove the net entirely and aim for the stratosphere? Because Metroid Ravenous is officially launching on January 28, 2027.
And the eShop data confirms it's supporting a 120 hertz output.
Which is insane. No Metroid game in history has ever broken the 60 frames per second barrier. Players are going to have a choice between a quality mode pushing crisp 4K resolution at 60 frames and this new performance mode, which dials the resolution back to 1080p but doubles the frame rate to 120.
The jump from 60 to 120 frames per second, it's difficult to articulate until you feel it in your hands. It fundamentally alters input latency.
I like to compare it to cars. Upgrading from 60 FPS to 120 FPS is like jumping from a standard sports car to a Formula One car. Every single micro adjustment, every reaction time matters.
That's a great analogy. It is the difference between a strobe light and a floodlight. Imagine watching a dancer in a dark room illuminated by a strobe light flashing 60 times a second. You see their general motion clearly.
But if that strobe flashes 120 times a second, suddenly you see the exact micro angle of their fingertips in midair.
Precisely. In an action game like Metroid, where boss fights require split-second evasions, your brain is receiving visual data twice as fast. Every microscopic adjustment you make on the analog stick translates to the screen with zero perceived delay.
You're having the time between when a frame is rendered and when your optic nerve actually processes it. And I'll tell you, once your muscle memory calibrates to that 120 hertz responsiveness, going back to 60 frames per second genuinely feels like your character is moving through water.
It really does. But beyond the technical marvel here, the release date is highly revealing.
Right, January 28th. Near the 35th anniversary, they're dropping a special edition with an art book, soundtrack, steelbook, and amiibo. But January. Usually Nintendo drops major titles in summer or fall.
Exactly. Placing a title of this magnitude in late January demonstrates immense internal confidence. Nintendo is signaling that Metroid Ravenous doesn't need the crutch of holiday gift-buying momentum.
They know it's going to sell anyway.
They expect it to anchor their software sales ecosystem for the entire first half of 2027 based purely on its own mechanical merits.
Well, first-party studios performing wizardry on their own hardware is one thing, but third-party developers shrinking massive current-generation worlds down to a mobile chipset. That is practically dark magic.
You're talking about Monster Hunter.
Oh, yes. Capcom is officially releasing Monster Hunter Wilds on the Switch 2 on December 4th, 2026.
This is a profound technical achievement. Monster Hunter Wilds originally launched in late 2025 for the PS5, Xbox Series, and high-end PCs.
And it is a huge game.
Massive. It features incredibly dense biomes and complex AI routines for the monsters. Compressing that architecture to run on a hybrid console requires ruthless optimization.
And they are delivering the complete game. Zero content cut, all previous title updates included, and they even engineered four-player local co-op so you can hunt in the same room without an internet connection, which is awesome. Plus, full cross-platform play.
The graphical compromises do exist, obviously.
Right.
We're looking at a dynamic 1080p while docked and 720p in handheld locked at 30 frames per second.
But still, here's where it gets really interesting. If Capcom can aggressively scale a massive PS5 game to run this cleanly on a Switch 2 without removing a single feature, were other developers just getting a bit lazy with their optimization in the past? Because we suffered through so many heavy compromises and unplayable cloud versions on the original Switch.
It exposes a real dichotomy in AAA development. Studios that treat portable ports as an afterthought often rely on automated scaling tools that just butcher performance.
Right, they just run it through a compressor and call it a day.
Exactly. But studios like Capcom, who build proprietary tech like the RE engine designed from the ground up for granular scalability, they can achieve these impossible ports. They can aggressively cull assets, scale down particle effects without altering hitboxes. They preserve the core feel. And the December 4th release date is equally calculated.
Hitting the absolute peak of the holiday shopping window.
Precisely. And by releasing it a full year after the PS5 launch, the day one PS5 and Xbox players essentially beta tested the game.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that makes total sense.
Every weapon balance patch, every bug fix over 2026 is baked directly into the Switch 2 cartridge. So the Switch 2 players get the most polished, complete version out of the box.
Okay, so while Capcom fits massive third-party worlds onto the Switch 2, Nintendo is taking one of his oldest, most historically linear first-party franchises and just blowing the walls off entirely.
Kirby and the World Beyond, revealed for spring 2027.
Yes, marketed as the franchise's first true sandbox open-world game for the 35th anniversary. And the most fascinating shift in the sources is how they're treating Kirby's copy abilities.
It marks a radical departure. Historically, Kirby inhales an enemy, gets a fire breath or a sword, and uses it strictly for combat.
Right, but now those abilities are primarily traversal mechanics for exploring this continuous world. Like, you might need a specific flying ability to navigate a vertical chasm.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, transitioning a combat ability into a traversal tool fundamentally rewires how the player interacts with the 35-year-old gameplay loop. It forces players to see the environment as a puzzle rather than just a stage.
Which ties perfectly into the narrative theme highlighted in the sources. The marketing is heavily leaning into a Truman Show comparison.
Which is fascinating.
Right. Is Nintendo getting incredibly meta here? Are they acknowledging that for 35 years, Kirby's vibrant, perfectly arranged worlds have basically been an artificial playground? And now he's breaking out.
It implies a level of narrative self-awareness that is highly unusual for the franchise. Treating the environment as a constructed wall the player has to dismantle elevates this well beyond a simple platformer.
It really does. But look, we've spent this entire deep dive talking about massive open worlds, 120-hertz action pipelines, cross-platform integration. None of those technical marvels exist without the immense human labor required to build them.
That brings us to a watershed moment for the workforce behind these games.
Exactly. We are looking at a historic labor shift, and I want to impart this impartially based purely on the facts in the contract. 1,900 workers at Activision Blizzard have successfully ratified a union contract with the Communications Workers of America.
This sets a massive precedent, particularly with the implementation of AI guardrails.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Because this contract doesn't outright ban generative AI, but it mandates transparency. It prevents Blizzard from using AI to replace workers or fundamentally alter roles without explicit union consultation.
Right. It shifts the integration of AI from a unilateral, top-down mandate to a negotiated process.
So what does this all mean?
Yeah.
It's like demanding AI be used as a co-pilot rather than an autopilot that just locks the human out of the cockpit.
That is a very accurate way to frame it. The contract also directly addresses layoff rights, installing hard contractual buffers in an industry known for sudden payroll cuts.
Yeah, the data says Blizzard is now mandated to provide 60 days of advance notice prior to any layoff. They must pay severance calculated at 1 week of pay per every 6 months worked. And they secured 14 months of recall rights, meaning priority rehiring if roles open back up.
They also secured protections against arbitrary forced return to office mandates. And the sources note this was paved largely by Microsoft's 2023 acquisition, where they agreed to respect unionization.
And looking at the data from the industry observers, this fundamentally changes the final product.
It does. The assertion in the report is that secure, happy workers who aren't burnt out by crunch culture or terrified of sudden layoffs, they actually take more creative risks.
Right, because they aren't worried about losing their jobs if a bold idea fails.
Exactly. Which ultimately results in better, more polished, and innovative games.
It really changes how you view the credits rolling at the end of a game. I mean, the single take and night broadcast perfectly encapsulates an industry maturing on all fronts, balancing flashy consumer hype with the GTA controllers, immense technical strides with Switch 2 VRR and Metroid, bold creative risks with Kirby, and the evolving rights of the human beings making it all happen at Blizzard.
And it leaves you with a really provocative thought to mull over. With union protections and AI guardrails taking root, how will the actual feel and soul of video games look 5 years from now when developers are finally given the safety to create without the looming shadow of sudden layoffs?
That is exactly what we should all be thinking about. Next time you boot up a game, just take a second to appreciate the human hands that built it. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Make sure to head over to takinggame.com to read through the full intelligence dossier for yourself. We will catch you on the next one.